Hi, I'm Henry Reingen. With me is Dr. Roy Clauser, and we're talking about the aspects of Hermann Dooyeweerd and the law framework in that Christian philosophy. And I tell you, Roy, I am happy to do this because I was a Dort student back in the early 1980s, a philosophy major, and that Christian college, Dort College, taught generously the theories of Dr. Hermann Dooyeweerd. And I've always wanted to be with a professor who loved Christian philosophy and to revisit these aspects of creation. So before we start, just give a quick couple minute review of what is an aspect and why it's important.
Okay.
And then we'll launch into talking about the aspect.
Yes, all right. Sounds good. That's an ordinary English term that Dooyeweerd takes and presses into having a technical meaning. An aspect is a kind of properties and laws exhibited by the things that we experience in the world around us. So, for example, there are quantitative properties to things.
Okay, that's actually the first one.
That's right. That's what we represent by numbers.
Okay.
Is the quantity of
it. So everything has a quantitative aspect to it.
That's right. It has some quantity or other, including negative.
Okay.
So you assign, we have a natural number series, and we can measure things, and we can number them, and so on, because everything does have quantitative properties. Things also have spatial properties.
Okay, hold on. Before we get to that. So we're on quantity. Yeah. I'm asking questions. I got to figure this out.
Sure.
I got to remember this all. So you write in The Myth of Religious Centrality, and I've quoted some. You said, the term quantitative is used to designate the how much of things and should not be misunderstood to refer to the theory of a realm of numbers or abstract systems of mathematics device for calculating quantity. I want you to unpack that before we move on.
Okay. It means that things have this kind of property.
Okay.
They really possess that. That's how math gets rolling. We see things have a how much. We want to be able to designate that, calculate it, and so on. We assign numbers. The natural number series is a series in which every number represents, every succeeding number represents an increase over the one just before it by the amount of the first.
Oh, okay.
But it's abstract because then these can be applied to anything. It doesn't matter whether you've got two or four atoms, two or four bottles, two or four clouds, animals, whatever you're doing, they all have quantity, and this is our way of getting at it and measuring.
Okay, so now think this through, everybody. Follow with me. So science is, philosophy is in a lot of ways the science of stepping above reality and analyzing it and trying to make sense out of its components and its essential aspects and being. So the first one, quantitative aspect, that everything is a number. There's one Henry, one Roy.
Can be counted.
It can
sure.
be counted. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. Is it possible to take this aspect of reality and reduce it religiously? Like, actually, somebody could take this one piece of reality and actually have a religious presupposition?
They can turn it into that, yeah. We define a religious belief as a belief in something as divine, where divine means the self-existent reality everything else depends on. Christians know that's only God, but lacking belief in God, other philosophers come along and put some substitute there. A popular one nowadays is the purely physical.
Okay.
Purely physical is the foundation of everything else. Whatever exists is either purely physical or produced by the purely physical, and it is self-existent. It's what generates everything. It's a God substitute.
Okay, so, but we're going to come to the purely physical in a little bit, right? So we're going to talk a little more about that. What about quantitative? Was there ever a time in philosophy history when somebody reduced the quantitative?
It's notorious. The ancient Pythagoreans not only did math, they thought everything was made of numbers. And numbers are the self-existent realities. They combine it to make those things that we see fall apart. But the numbers themselves don't come into being and pass away.
They actually worshipped numbers?
They worshipped them. They had a prayer to the number 10 that I put in that book.
A lot of
people find it very amusing that anybody pray to the number 10, but they can hardly say that Pythagoras is a dummy or something. He's looking at the world and he's wondering, why is it that we do math correctly? Reality always turns out to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And his answer is the correspondence is because things are made of those numbers.
Gotcha.
So you do the right calculation, that it comes out. A more modern example might be somebody like Werner Heisenberg. Heisenberg says that in his book, Physics and Philosophy, that he's sure that when we get to the ultimate laws of reality, they're going to turn out to be mathematical laws of motion for motion.
Okay.
And he says he regards those as the ultimate explainer. Okay, so it's the ultimate reality. And then he adds voluntarily, mm-hmm. this fits with the Pythagorean religion.
Ah.
And I know of no one who's ever proven that this is right, he says, but I and many of my colleagues share this belief. But he recognizes its religious character.
I'll tell you, one of the reasons I love Christian philosophy is because it seeks to see those places where we reduce something to an idol and serve a created aspect or a thing rather than the creator. So even quantitative is possibly reduced. Now here's spatial. Here's another aspect Dr. Doiwer talked about. So what is continuous extension?
Well, that's...
I mean, when I hear that, continuous extension.
Well, but he's trying to give a circumscription there of our experience of space as extended.
Okay.
And then we perceive objects in space. And
but
they
give
have
an location example. I need an example of
size
that.
Size and things like
okay,
that.
Okay, so what's an example of the spatial aspect?
Well, it's the spatial properties that we experience things to have. They're relational. We see one thing over here, one's to the right, one's to the left.
I'm right here, you're right there.
That's right.
I mean, that's an aspect?
Yeah.
I mean, that just seems so
well,
simple. Why is that an aspect?
Okay. Why is it? Because it's a distinct kind of properties related by a distinct kind of laws.
Okay.
So numbers are related by mathematical laws. But
okay.
When you start calculating spaces, you involve geometric laws as well.
Ah, and so this is like taking off on geometry. This planet is here, that planet is here.
Yeah.
It's almost, I mean, in human ways, if I all of a sudden get really close to you, I'm violating a spatial...
My personal space.
Okay. I mean, it's the social somewhat, which we'll talk about later, but there's also the concept...
About space, yeah.
And there's science of space, is that right?
Sure.
Spatial science?
Sure. The sciences have arisen, Dewey can show this historically,
right.
When people noticed and then focused on and abstracted one kind of properties and laws, and then they go in there and they raise problems, they make theories, they try to develop what they found, and so you get advances in math, advances in geometry, advances in physics. But you can do that without regarding any of them as God substitutes. You don't have
right.
to regard anything as the self-existent reality that produces everything else in order to study it.
Okay.
Has anyone
ever reduced the spatial to the place of God, or is this one?
Yes.
Sort of?
Yeah. Sure. They've reduced everything else to space. John Wheeler held a view like that. And the steady state theorists of earlier in the 20th century did that, Bondi, Gold, and Hoyle. For Fred Hoyle, what we call matter is like concentrated space. Space is infinite, eternal, and uncreated, and it spontaneously generates protons, according to Hoyle.
Okay.
And that's where matter comes from. So, and then everything else you explain as dependent on matter, but matter in turn is dependent on space.
I mean, think of Romans 1 here, where they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And
worship and serve something created instead of the creator. That's
you can actually worship space. So your Christian philosophy is trying to say, you know, Christ is Lord of all, God created the heavens and the earth, we've fallen into sin, the creation groans. Christ has redeemed in his death, his resurrection, his ascension, and so that orders our reality, but without our reality ordered by God, we could simply find something else to do. Now,
let me say something about worship and serve for a moment. You jumped on that and said that these people worship this, and a lot of them don't do that. The Pythagoreans worship the numbers of a present day Pythagorean would worship.
Right, right.
But that's not essential to the beliefs being a religious belief. There are a number of major religions in the world in which there is no worship. Brahmin Hinduism, Theravada Buddhism, Shinto. So we're not saying you have to worship something in order to make it a God substitute. Notice Paul says worship or served.
Yeah.
So you can worship and still be in thrall to and serve.
Your highest reality.
Yes, this is the most real thing, the metaphysically ultimate. All the terms that are used for that. Lotzi put it in Taoism, the unproduced producer of all else. Same thing. That's what we're talking about. We know that that's only God.
Right. So when I say worship or something like that, that's the definition. It's elevating or serving something as the ultimate reality.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the kinetic? Now, that's another aspect. So we've got the numerical, we have spatial, and the third one that Dr. Doyward pioneered was the kinetic.
Yeah.
Kinetics.
A lot of people include that under physical, but at least two influential thinkers regarded it as distinct, Galileo and Einstein.
Oh, so if you're with Galileo and Einstein,
not bad company. So he regards them as distinct. For a physical thing to exist and exert its effects and so on, there has to be space in which it exists. So it precedes, it's a precondition for things being physical.
Now, in flowing movement, kinetic, you say kinetic is used to designate the movement of things, their motion in space. Many scientists include these properties and laws within physical aspects, as you just said.
Yeah, right.
Though Galileo seems not to have done that, and at least two contemporary thinkers have argued persuasively that it's actually a distinct aspect, and one of them is Einstein.
Yeah. And Doyward.
And Doyward.
He has his own arguments for that. He gives them some detail.
But get practical on this. What would be a practical example of this aspect?
I was just thinking of the quote I gave you from Heisenberg.
Okay.
The ultimate laws of reality are going to be mathematical laws for motion.
Motion. Ah.
So everything, motion is fundamental to everything. So you have this controversy.
Hold on. There's motion in this chair, right? Or this.
Well, sure. There's atomic motion. Even if this as a whole isn't moving across the room, I mean, if our discussion gets violent and you chase me around with it, it will move. But it's capable of moving, and internally it is.
Right.
So
change.
Yes, that's right.
So things change.
Yeah. You can claim that that's the most fundamental feature of reality, and that everything else depends on there being matter that changes. The purely physical, but in motion.
Now, surely no one has reduced this to a religious belief.
Heisenberg thought,
really?
Thought that his view of math plus motion was just like the Pythagoreans.
Okay, but he added motion in there.
Yeah. I guess another person you could include there would be Epicurus, if you're trying to think of the history of thought.
Okay.
For Epicurus, the fundamental realities were space and atoms.
Okay.
But the atoms are intrinsically in motion.
Ah.
This is the opposite of Aristotle. So for Epicurus, the atoms change. They go into different combinations. Given enough time, they'll go through every possible change. This world is one possible change, one possible state for all the atoms to be in space. So it was inevitable that this world show up sooner or later, and being one of the more stable ones, it lasts long enough for humans to arise and so on. And so we know about that, but we don't need a creator to explain this. It can explain itself. You just make space and atoms and motion
really
self-existent realities.
Change. And that actually is an aspect of our reality. It's, it should not be reduced, but it truly is an aspect.
So we in this philosophy avoid that controversy that existed for a long time. Is the natural state of things to be at rest or to be in motion? And neither one is fundamental to the other. The most fundamental thing is for things to depend on God.
Right.
And then they then have motion as one of their characteristics.
Now, I don't know if you've heard that. I don't know if you heard that. There, Dr. Clauser slipped in a theory out there in philosophy, at rest or at motion. So who is that?
Well, Aristotle argued the natural state of everything is to be at rest. Right. All we have to explain is why change ever takes place.
Right.
That's precisely what Galileo tossed out and began the rise of what we call modern science. Galileo does a thought experiment. Think of something traveling through space.
Right.
If nothing ever, nothing else ever impinges on it, why would it ever stop?
Okay.
So he says, look, it's not that rest is natural and motion is unnatural and you've got to explain it. It's that, that a thing in motion will remain in motion. A thing at rest will remain at rest unless acted on by an external force.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So I just wanted you to know that there's a little like philosophic insider information that he actually slipped to you all. So that you can, as you study philosophy, you can actually, oh, I saw that quote. Now next is the physical aspect.
That's a very popular one today. In philosophy, someone who claims that everything is fundamentally physical is called a materialist. That doesn't mean that that person's out for all the money they can get and wants to amass possessions.
Well, that's, most that's, people think that way.
That's
a sermon is done. Do you have a material world? And are you living like a material girl?
Yeah.
You're not talking that.
No, we're not talking about that.
Okay.
So this would probably be better called physicalist. But that sounds weird and strange. So they go under the title materialists. And these are people who think that the ultimate reality is matter and energy.
Okay.
And that everything can be explained by that. That is to say, everything is either purely physical or produced by the purely physical.
Mm-hmm.
And the big controversy in this is the relation between brains and minds.
Really?
Well, minds seem to have non-physical properties.
All right.
It doesn't look to us in our immediate pre-theoretical experience. It doesn't appear to us that something, that a wish, a desire, an attitude such as "I hate that" or whatever, that those are physical things.
Right.
So the materialist has to show that somehow they are, that they are merely brain processes or some activity of a neural network someplace,
right?
And they're divided over just how real, how real and how really non-physical the other things are, like such as concepts and so on. Well, do you admit there are such things? Well, some of them say no, some of them say yes, and some of them go so far as to say that the mind is a distinct thing from the brain. But it's caused by the brain. It's always dependent on the brain at that point.
Okay, so we have to even have time out here because you just said so many things there that, you know. Okay, so first of all, you said pre-theoretical thinking. Now, okay, so
aside from theory.
You're with me on this, aren't you? Okay, so we're going to try to get this. So the pre-theoretical thinking is what, just like living, naive experience, observation?
Yeah, sure.
Not, you know, paying attention to
the world as it appears to everybody. The materialist term for this is that it's the manifest reality. It's what we see.
What we observe. Okay. Then theoretic thinking is what we're doing in this philosophy class, and philosophers, like those in the physical realm or the materialists, as you talked about, what they're trying to do is make a science out of making sense out of our existence. So when the brain and the mind are all working out, they're trying to connect that we're all energy. Or that
sure,
aspect of energy.
But there, there are various degrees of reducing other things to the physical.
Okay.
There's on the one extreme, someone who says, no, all things are only physical. They only have physical characteristics. They're only governed by physical laws.
Okay.
Which has the severe unanswerable difficulty that the guy who's making that theory is using logic to argue for it and saying there are no logical laws. There are only physical laws.
Wow.
So that's a mess. Then there are people that say, no, there are logical laws and there are minds, but they're produced by the physical.
Gotcha.
And so that's the logical rules are the ones by which we can't help thinking. We can't get away from them. If you toss them out, you're not conceiving of anything. So there's some kind of distinctness about logical properties and laws, but it depends on, they depend on the physical.
Okay.
On there being physical brains and so on.
Now, they would say they're not reducing reality to this, are they? I mean, are they just pointing out that everything is energy? In their own interpretation, it's just energy, and are they reducing everything?
Yeah, that's their term. When you take two what appear to be two distinct kinds of properties, that's the manifest image, they call it. It's what we all begin by experiencing.
Okay.
Now we want to inquire, though, what's really going on. So
right.
If we're a materialist, we say what's really going on is that the physical is the ultimate reality, and it's in charge, and its laws and properties generate everything else, if there is anything else.
If there is anything else.
If there's anything non-physical, it's generated by the physical.
Is that like the Star Wars, the Force be with you? I mean, what? You know, like who espouses this view right now?
A lot of very prominent thinkers. I wouldn't say that materialism is a majority of philosophers, but it's a very active plurality. It may be the largest single group. I'm not sure. But they're very well-known thinkers, and they are very vocal.
How did they really go against God's order or the Bible's revelation?
I mean, well, they would say, but that's all some kind of nonsense. And we know that things are only physical, and that the physical world went through stages from the Big Bang on, and the conditions on Earth were right for life to arise, and animals and plants evolved, and humans did, that have brains that can think logically and mathematically, and aren't just in the control of the physical needs and glands,
right,
and stuff like that. So they have to explain how that's possible. And taking one kind of properties that appears to be distinct from another and trying to show that it really is only the other is called a reduction argument.
Right.
Reduce this to this.
Right.
And some of those are eliminated. They get rid of the others altogether. And some say, no, there are such properties, but they're completely caused
who's
by
the father
physical.
Or who's the father and mother philosopher of that one? Who actually kind of introduced this?
Oh, materialism's old.
Oh, it goes back to ancient times.
Oh, sure, sure.
Okay, so it's old.
500 BC, you've got people saying it's atoms, and the atoms combine to form everything.
Okay. So now you may say, oh, you know, I feel like a little lost here, because some of this is pretty deep philosophic reflection into energy and matter and its philosophic implications. Would you say that there's something practical in my naive experience, my everyday life, I can get from understanding this? I mean, what
from understanding materialism?
Yeah, to understand materialism. I mean, I put my discernment cap on, and I listen to arguments, I read the news, all of these things. And if this is a prominent worldview, that means the presupposition, the claims that are religious are going to be made in this one because it's a very prominent one.
Okay.
So what are some of the markers that cue us that somebody has this worldview?
I think Christians have always held, whatever their inclinations in philosophy, have always held that what the materialist dismisses as what he calls the manifest image, which then concludes is illusory.
Oh, it's an illusion.
That's the world God made and put us in, and
right.
That's real.
Right.
I'd be hard-pressed to think of a Christian who didn't hold that.
Okay.
And not only that, even if they follow in the pathway of philosophy of trying to find the ultimate nature of the world that God created, and even if they come up with, well, it's this or this or this combination, so on, they're still saying, ultimately, that depends on God. Nothing we can find in creation is what makes the rest of creation.
Gotcha.
So they've always rejected that kind of dismissal of our everyday experience as illusory.
I got it.
Yeah.
Okay, one more, and this is part one of the aspects, and that's going to be, well, I mean, this is, you know, I think after we do some of these, we got to take a little rest.
Yes.
And then got to recharge a little bit and get back
Definitely.
Into it. So the biotic, you know, what life function, self-maintenance. So the biotic, now that feels different than the physical, because now it feels like living beings aspect.
Yeah,
is
sure.
there a difference? Is there like something shifted here, changed?
Yeah, sure. They are alive. They carry on metabolic processes. They have to ingest, digest, eliminate. They have to reproduce. And none of those things are done by things that are qualified physically, like rocks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So there's something new here, but there is, every time you go from one aspect to another, there's a distinct kind of, and I would, if I were writing this, I'd hyphenate it, properties and laws.
Right.
Properties that exhibit an orderliness because there are laws that hold among them, among the properties of the same kind.
So a scientist can look at this aspect of reality, and there's actually a set of laws that guide this aspect in differentiation.
Yeah, that's usually what they're looking for, the laws of
an aspect.
Of matter, of life, of quantity in mathematics or whatever. And it goes on.
Hold on, I have a question. So there's mathematics in the biotic. Earlier aspects?
Sure. When you have a cell reproduce, the DNA splits and each side generates a new side,
right.
And you go
one to two.
Of course.
And you got numbers there.
Of course.
Are there other ones there too? There's is there spatial there in this
sure.
So where
you only had one, now you have two and they occupy more space, and how they relate to other things can be traced out in other ways too.
What about the physical? So the biotic, but there's also energy and matter and...
Of course.
But is the biotic matter different than the physical matter?
No. It's still matter. See, now, there have been people that resisted the idea that biology can be reduced to physics. And they have gone to the extreme of making it utterly independent.
Okay.
And saying that matter itself changes when it becomes part of a living thing, it's a biomass or whatever.
Right.
And I think that's going to the other extreme. It's a distinct kind of properties and laws. Not everything has biotic properties actively.
Right.
But in each of these kinds of properties, all things in creation have some property or other of every one of the aspects.
Okay.
But either actively or passively.
Okay, so I'll hold that thought because this is way too late in this presentation before we launch into that. I mean, because I'll have a lot of questions when you get to that. But so we're in this presentation with asking this question, has somebody reduced the biotic as their ultimate reality?
There are a couple of people. It hasn't been a very popular theory, but there have been a few that have said that the universe as a whole is a living organism, and we are parts of it. Plato went through that.
I think I saw a Star Trek episode that sort of did that.
Yeah.
So Plato was the one that did that?
Plato tried it for a while, and there have been a few others that have proposed it, even in the 20th century, the early 20th century. But it's never been a popular view, a widespread view in philosophy, the way materialism has. Or the way dualism has. They're the two biggies.
Now, you know, I can think of some, if I'm a minister in a ministry, I can think of some practical ways the sinful nature reduces the biotic, where you have urges, sexual urges, and you just basically act on them. That aspect of reproducing is out of balance, sinful, out of balance, and then you objectify people. So I can see when you're in ministry, some of these aspects start creating like an ethical piece, because while we're going to get one later called the ethical, it's don't love your neighbor. But I know working in the restorative justice, Those some people just do it because they have such raging hormones, they say, and they've reduced their life to their raging hormones rather than, you know, try. You
they've
know,
made it a priority over everything else,
right? Yeah. But it almost becomes like their reality.
Yeah. Well, it does. It shapes how they live. So
it's what's interesting as we study philosophy. We're going to find out as we get into these aspects that relate to the biotic onward, we're going to start seeing like aspects of character in them, how we can, you know, we're going to start seeing how we can reduce our, as you call it, pre-theoretic thought life, that is our naive experience, our experience. We can, you know, this starts becoming not just practical for philosophy, but we can start thinking about our living our life, and maybe we are reducing ourselves, or we see in ministry that there's reduction going on in terms of like the, so now it's not just the study of philosophy, but it helps us organize various practical ways.
If I can rephrase,
go ahead.
I think what you're saying is that there is an analogy in everyday life to the project of reducing one aspect to another in philosophy has a mirror image in overemphasizing one side of life and having it dominate all the others instead of a kind of even-handed distribution. Yeah, I get it.
Well, I sometimes think of like, and I don't know if I heard the term way back in my dork days, or I made it up as a minister, but I have no idea. But I use the term meaning moments. These are sort of like moments that in philosophy makes the science out of them, but they have powerful meaning as we live our ordinary life before God. I've been surprised in my devotions over the years, or in my prayers, and in my discipleship through the Holy Spirit and His Word, that sometimes aspects of philosophy, like the biotic or whatever, have such a weight that I can just practically reduce myself to this or others. In fact, we're going to talk about them now.
Well,
they're like meaning moments. They're just
right. That's not always wrong. I mean, if we're hiking and we drop the bag with the food in it and it floats away down the river, then we better make a priority out of finding some food, a biotic priority there. Or when you're crossing the street, you better make a priority about calculating the right space. Do I have time to get across without getting flattened?
Right.
So that those things come and go. But what you're talking about is some obsession whereby somebody places some temporal value in such high esteem that it absorbs the rest of life, and
it almost becomes your kind of like unspoken aspiration or who you really bow down to. I think of like dieting. This, my wife and I are trying to, well, you know, this is biotic, right? So we're like getting books and reading and all of these things, and then my brother-in-law works at an emergency room in Bellingham, Washington, and he says in the last 10 years. Extreme obesity has run rampant, and now they have to have like lifts and all of these things to help people and to move people. And there's even a program on TV. And again, there's no judgment here. I'm not trying to say that anyone's value is less before the eyes of God, but it is a practical place where, as stewards of our own body, the biotic. So the philosophy, at this point, we start seeing lots of places where we study it scientifically, but we also can see there's a lot of meaning moments in practical life where we're trying to like not make one piece of our existence apart from our worship.
But I think that's one of the big differences between the way belief in God can be our dominant goal of pleasing God, living for God. It doesn't require us to give up all the rest of life or to regard it as illusory or just not important. There are people who are given that call who may give up a normal life and just lead a life of prayer and solitude, but they're the minority.
Right.
For the majority of people, they're equally believers in God and equally sincere in their devotion. And so on. But then by making the focal point of what leads the whole right. of your life to be God outside the creation.
Right.
God, a goddess, he's in us, but transcends creation. We don't then overemphasize any part of the creation.
Right.
It gives us an even-handed view. We can participate in all the aspects of life.
We can seize moderation in a way that glorifies God and don't take one aspect and take it out of its really design. And that's what's so great about philosophy, everybody, is that you're studying the theoretic, the science of understanding and meaning and reality, but we're getting insights, meaning moments into your practical life as you read the Word of God and as you live your life before the Lord. So, anyway, this is part one. We'll wrap this up here. And after you get a little recharge, come back and check us out on part two of the aspects of reality.